This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The financial cost of shutting down a 20-kilometer zone in Japan for goodness knows how long is just too great a cost to bear for any energy production system. It's a crazy scenario that you can actually have a supposed asset turn into such a liability.
Last week on Sea Change Radio, we heard from someone who, despite the recent nuclear disaster in Japan, defended the continued exploration of nuclear power as part of the new energy equation. This week, we'll hear an alternative perspective. Our first guest is solar power executive Danny Kennedy, who thinks that nuclear power is more of a problem than a solution, and that investment in renewable energy is a more practical, safer, and far more reasonable approach. Then I speak with geophysicist Ben Brooks, a specialist in earthquake science who works with breakthrough technology in seismology and GPS. He explains what scientists now understand about the different types of earthquakes and talks about the West Coast's vulnerability to the type of quake that recently struck northern Japan. My guest on Sea Change Radio is Danny Kennedy, the founder of Sungevity Home Solar Specialists. Danny, great to have you back on the show.
Hey, Alex.
You wanted to talk this week because there's so much going on in the news, especially in Japan, with the nuclear disaster in wake of the tsunami and the earthquake there, and thought that this could be one of those times where we could be talking about the shifts in energy and how we're transitioning to a cleaner energy tomorrow. What kind of thoughts did you initially have as you saw these events unfolding on your TV and on the internet?
Well, obviously, I think everyone's thoughts are with the Japanese people living with the tsunami and the earthquake and now the after effects of it in the form of this nuclear disaster. And, you know, we hope that they all come through that as well as they can. But it also just sort of begs this bigger question about our energy choices and the fact that we're still relying on these crazy 19th and 20th century technologies that really are showing their limits, I think, at the start of the 21st century. If you think just about the last year, we've seen, you know, the massive coal mine disaster in Virginia and just a human felt example of how bad coal really is, although it's worse than that. In fact, it's worse than the nuclear industry because this is when the nukes go wrong, the problem we got in Fukushima, whereas when coal goes right, it's causing those sorts of problems for people and the planet. We saw here in the Bay Area the very real impacts of the natural gas industry with the San Bruno explosion. Then we saw the Gulf oil spill and the devastation the oil industry brings home onto our shores. And now we're seeing Fukushima and the risks inherent in nuclear industries. So it's just sort of like a harbinger, I guess, of the change that's happening, which is to get off dirty energy systems and onto clean. Because all that period, all the while, the solar industry and the clean economy has been growing gangbusters. It's been a pretty remarkable couple of years. Through the Great Recession, clean energy industries generally grew. Solar has had a compounded annual growth rate of about 70%, which is amazing given the Great Recession. And in the last year, it was the fastest growing sector in the economy, creating tens of thousands of jobs. So, you know, it's a good news story in amidst all this gloom. And I guess that was sort of the frame and the conversation we wanted to have.
Let's focus on nuclear because that is on a lot of people's mind and a lot of people are reevaluating their position in terms of where nuclear fits in that puzzle. You just mentioned how coal is definitely worse than nuclear in the scale of evils. And no one's denying that renewables and clean energy need more advocacy than nuclear. But what about the call to build and update our nuclear grid?
There's no question we've got to make things safe that we've got in the system, but that doesn't mean updating them and extending their life. You know, that's the decision the Germans have already taken post-Fukushima. And it would be crazy to use this as an excuse to embed us in that wrong technology path. the fact that they underestimated the risks just means that nuclear power has gone from, you know, allegedly going to be too cheap to meter, which was the promise of the nuclear physicists and engineers back in the 50s and 60s when things like Fukushima were on the drawing boards, to the fact that nuclear is too expensive to insure. You know, that's the bottom line. We here in the United States exempt them effectively from liability by the Price-Anderson Act and other means. And you know, the bottom line for me is a bottom line calculation, which is that you can talk all you like about updating and upgrading nuclear, but no one in the private sector is going to get behind that seriously because it's just too expensive. And the financial cost of shutting down a 20-kilometer zone in Japan for goodness knows how long is just too great a cost to bear for any energy production system. It's a crazy scenario that you can actually have a supposed asset turn into such a liability that you're going to, you know, shut it down. Or the Chernobyl case, where you've basically turned a whole area into a sacrifice zone for a country that was once productive agricultural land. You know, that shouldn't be a price borne by a society. Even though the nuclear industry profiteers want to make a buck, communities shouldn't have to, you know, have those costs socialized and put on them. And that's why nukes ultimately won't grow.
This is Alex Wise, my guest on Sea Change Radio's Danny Kennedy, the founder of Sungevity Home Solar Specialists. And in full disclosure, Sungevity is a sponsor of the show. Danny, George Monbiot wrote an op-ed in The Guardian saying that Fukushima actually made him more pro-nuclear. He was on the fence, and this convinced him that nuclear had to be a part of the solution because, and his logic was a little controversial to say the least, but it was interesting. And then he said, we had one of the largest earthquakes the world has ever recorded, this massive tsunami, and an old, out-of-date, pretty crummy nuclear plant that we're finding now that was, it had lots of holes in their security systems and their safety issues. And yet it looks like it can't even compare to the people that died in the tsunami and the earthquake. He says that if we can get over this, then this is maybe the worst that can happen, and it wasn't so bad. How would you respond to George Monbiot?
I think you nailed it when you said it was controversial. I think that's George's stock and trade. I don't understand the logic really at all. I think, you know, the reality is there's a difference between natural disasters and human-made disasters. And no question that tsunami is a greater tragedy and the earthquake is a greater problem for our society, but they're not something in our control. There's something we can mitigate the effects of through better urban planning and design and building and so on. But, you know, that we're at peril to nature is a reality of the species. What we shouldn't be is at peril to our own technology choices, the difference being the choice. We chose to build Fukushima in the middle of a community. We didn't choose to have an earthquake or the tsunami. And so I don't, as I say, really understand the argument. As I understand the precautionary principle, it says that the burden of proof is on the developer of something or the creator of something to show that it's not going to cause risk. And you can't do that in this case because uncontemplated risks exist. And, you know, in 68, they didn't know about subduction earthquakes. So be it. There's lots of known unknowns and unknown unknowns today that mitigate against the growth of the nuclear industry.
But if you take that to, like, coal, comparing nuclear to coal rather than nuclear to totally clean energy like wind and solar, because it's apples to oranges, really. But let's take nuclear to coal, hundreds of times more dangerous. And we already know that there's tens of thousands of people who are developing black lung and fracking, natural gas fracking, that are getting their water table poisoned. There's lots of other externalities associated with all these other dirty energy technologies, but we don't see this kind of gripping event usually unfolding in front of our eyes like we did with Fukushima. And it really, sometimes the imagination can capture and deflate any progress that can be made in that technology.
No question, you know, there's a greater of two evils, but that doesn't mean that you've got to make the Faustian bargain to accept one of them. And that's the point here, is that meanwhile, the clean energy industry grows apace and shows the potential to displace all of this dirty energy. I mean, It's a pretty simple choice, really. You can have coal, oil, nukes, and gas, all of which have inherent fatal flaws, in my view. And they're financial. They're economic. They cost too much to the society that bears them to continue them ad infinitum. And so they will be phased out on a cost-benefit analysis. The other options, the ones that take fuel free from the sky, wind, solar, and so on, they will scale, and they are scaling. That's the good news story here. You know, and we really just have to keep our eyes on the prize and the reality that 100 or 200 years from now, this civilization will not be nuclear-powered and it will not be coal-powered for a variety of reasons that we can go into. They will be powered with clean energy sources, and it's really just a question of how quickly we make that transition and how many more people we expose to black lung or climate change impacts and weather-related disasters and vector-borne diseases because of warming or radiation sickness and poisoning because of the silliness of depending on nuclear power. We should expose as few as we can. That's, you know, the best approach possible. Phase them out as quickly as possible. Don't extend their life and don't reinvest in technologies that have failed. I mean, to finish the rant, I just think it's kind of like it's a zeitgeist thing. It's, you know, do you really believe that in the 21st century, the era of Facebook and you know, the web and the wonders of the networked society, we're going to get stuck on dumb things that burn stuff that you dig up from the ground or boil off water from its inherent radioactivity? Or do you think we're going to go to a distributed generating resource set which takes fuel free from the sky? I mean, I believe in the optimism of humanity and the smarts of civilization to move to the better technology set. And the fact that the economics are now on our side, because if you calculate the true costs of what Fukushima is causing, the global economy, there's no way in hell you can pencil out investment in nuclear power plants going forward.
And if you look at how we've ignored the sunk cost theory, and we keep doubling down on this, each time we reinvest in older, dirtier technology, that's investment that's lost from a clean energy future.
Exactly. And that's the point that I think we're at. The good news is, you know, we're talking here on the 23rd, I think, of March, just after the equinox of spring. You know, more light is here in the Northern Hemisphere every day rather than darkness as we go forward through the year. And I feel like that's the turning point we've just made in the decade. Like, there's more light every week and month with good news stories. Our little company here at Sungevity has just, in the last 10 weeks, interconnected 1 megawatt of solar projects on people's roofs around America. You know, we're going into 5 more states next month. We're growing tenfold the rate of acceleration. Our financiers are telling us that they're putting 10 megawatts of residential solar online every month. You know, we're really competing with nuclear power plants that are hundreds of megawatts in scale. We're doing it faster, cheaper, and cleaner than those guys can even dream of, and it's happening today.
And those are heavily subsidized industries as well.
All energy is a subsidized industry. Like, there's no energy source that is not heavily subsidized, the nuclear industry most of all, with the investment of the military-industrial complex to get it going in the first place, and then all of the externalization of its true costs, whether it be waste management or emergency management, as we've seen in Fukushima. So yes, you know, we're doing much better, much faster, and for much less cost than they do. And I think that's the true narrative of the next decade. And that's what it's, you know, hopefully we can look back in 20 years and say that problem at Fukushima marked the shift, the power shift in society towards clean energy.
Danny Kennedy, the founder of Sungevity, thanks for being our guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
It's a sad communication with little reason to believe. When one isn't giving, and one pretends to receive, you brought it all on, oh,
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
Our next guest on Sea Change Radio is my good friend Ben Brooks. He is the director of the Pacific GPS Facility and the University of Hawaii Institute of Geophysics and Planetology. And his specialty is tectonic geodesy. Ben, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
You're considered an expert in seismology and earthquake sciences. Tell us a little bit about how the earthquake that just decimated the north part of Japan is different from the one that occurred a couple years ago in Haiti or in Chile.
The earthquake that just occurred in Japan is actually similar, very similar in many ways to the one that occurred last year in Chile, the Maule event. And I've been studying that in quite some detail. And it's completely different than the event that occurred in Haiti prior to that. The sizes of the two types of events, to call it the Chile and Japan event in one end member and then the Haiti event in another, are enormously different. I can't remember the exact, I think it's well over 100 times bigger, the Chile events, than the Haiti one.
But it's not just the size difference. There's actually a different type of earthquake, a subduction earthquake that occurred in Japan. Is that
right?
Is that what led to the devastation from the tsunami? And that's why you wouldn't get a tsunami type event in Haiti?
Well, there are a couple of things wrapped up in that question. So,
from a layman's standpoint, we only have the Richter scale to look for.
Right.
Break it down a little more detailed rather than just comparing a 7.1 to a 9.0 and then saying it's this much bigger. But there's actually the devil is in the details right here.
They were different types of earthquakes. And let's just say the Haiti earthquake versus the Japanese earthquake. One was a subduction zone event, which is sort of more like a fault that's slipping, and the fault is sort of like your driveway ramp versus the wall of your garage, which is a vertical wall, which would be the Haiti earthquake. And in that case, each side of the wall slipped past each other. So that was called a strike slip fault. And the movement is primarily horizontal in that case. In the Japanese earthquake, the movement has a vertical component as well. And those tend to occur on subduction zones. Subduction zones tend to be near oceans. And so then you can get a large vertical movement of the seafloor, which then causes tsunami. Haiti, of course, is near an ocean too, but that type of event doesn't typically cause a tsunami. That's one thing, is the type of event which would cause a tsunami. The second thing, though, is that the Haiti earthquake occurred over an incredibly densely populated area. It was actually a relatively small event that occurred over a very densely populated area with poor construction standards. So that's a major difference. Actually, that's sort of more of a difference with respect to the Chilean earthquake. The Chilean earthquake only had something like 500 deaths. That's still a very large number, but nothing in comparison to the Haitian earthquake.
And these subduction earthquakes were not known until the late 60s, correct?
So the plate tectonics revolution came about during the 60s when earthquake observations, seismological observations, and geological observations and a lot of different types of observations were combined into this theory of these plates moving around on the Earth, which is now generally accepted and proven. But two things happened in the 60s. Actually, two different big subduction zone earthquakes happened, which were really the first two in the sort of measured or the instrumented time period, the 1960 Chilean earthquake and the 1964 Alaskan earthquake. So the study of those earthquakes, which occurred in the sort of mid to late 60s and 70s, enabled researchers to realize that you could get these huge earthquakes, these magnitude 9 earthquakes, which typically were associated with tsunami.
So when the science community was able to isolate the difference between these types of geological events, like a subduction earthquake that would lead to a massive tsunami, it's right around the same time we can guess that the Fukushima reactor that's now in dire straits was in the idea phase at that point, correct?
From what I've read on the web and newspaper articles and things like that, that reactor, the Mark I reactor, I think, well, over there in Fukushima, was started to be built in 71. So you can think, okay, well, then it was probably you know, plan significantly before that, say 10 years, something like that. And the point is that those reactors, or that reactor at least, that the one that ran into so much trouble, was designed at the same time that we were figuring out that these huge earthquakes could occur. Now, that doesn't excuse not retrofitting after all this was established in the scientific literature. And especially, I mean, the Japanese have this long and very illustrious history of seismology and geosciences in general. And they're actually, their government is very progressive in terms of what they do in terms of earthquake hazards and preparedness.
But this was originally built at a substandard level in terms of the seawall. Obviously, in terms of what when we look at, it was built for, I think, like 7 or 8 meters, and the event was 14 meters or something like that, the tsunami.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that illustrates more just the difficulty of doing hazards analysis or planning for events that occur very infrequently on the human timescales. The recurrence intervals, the time between repeating events on these faults, can be on the order of hundreds of years or even sometimes thousands of years.
You'll never make us run. You're a partner to the devil, but we ain't afraid of him. And we'll build ourselves another town so you can tear it down.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is the director of the Pacific GPS Facility at the Hawaii Institute of Geophysics and Planetology, Professor Ben Brooks. Ben, a lot of people in California, when they heard about this event in Japan, their first reaction was, well, we could easily get this kind of an earthquake here. And we have San Onofre nuclear facility down near Los Angeles is right on the ocean as well. But actually, the Pacific Northwest is much more susceptible to a similar subduction type earthquake than a Los Angeles, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
And then can you tell us about the genesis of that science and how that came about? Because there hasn't been a massive earthquake in Seattle since I've been around, right?
Right. The tectonic framework of the West Coast of the United States can be divided into sort of two main regions, north and south of Mendocino, California. South of Mendocino, the San Andreas Fault dominates, and that's this mostly horizontal motion, this lateral motion.
And that's where you see the 1906 earthquake, where like the ground just leapt from one side to the other, right? These kind of massive fault lines.
Right. The fault is actually exposed right at the surface. And then north of Mendocino, you get the Cascadia subduction zone. And so you can get these subduction zone earthquakes. Now, that wasn't recognized that that could occur until the late 80s. It's actually a seismically fairly quiescent place. There isn't much seismicity normally there. In the late 80s, geologist Brian Atwater, studying the forests of the Pacific Northwest along the coast, realized that there were a bunch of these drowned forests that seemed, there were a bunch of dead trees that he wondered what the explanation was for them. And doing geological dating, he realized that many of them all died at very close to the same time, and that in the geological record as well, there were these layers of sands which came right after the drowning, which were best explained as tsunami deposits. And so he started to infer that there were some big earthquakes that occurred and caused tsunami, local tsunami. And then it turned out that in Japan, there were records. Japan had been historically keeping very meticulous records of many things, the samurai. And it turned out that there was a tsunami in 1700 that was not correlated with a local earthquake. They knew that you could have tsunami after earthquake. They've known that for a long time. But this one was sort of this mystery tsunami. So it turns out that that's right at the time that one of these drowned forests occur. And so Atwater initially pieced together that, okay, this was a huge Cascadia earthquake that caused the tsunami all the way over on the other side of the Pacific in Japan. And the reverse just happened. So Crescent City got a big tsunami from this Japanese earthquake.
Crescent City, California.
Yeah, Crescent City, California.
So disaster management and hazard preparedness aside, what kind of lessons do you think we can take from these last three events in Haiti, Japan, and Chile and apply them to the area of sustainability?
I think in a general sense, it's to try to pay attention to the lessons that science is teaching us. And in this case, for geology and the study of earthquakes, it's teaching us that earthquakes repeat on the order of hundreds of years, sometimes 100 or up to hundreds, up to even thousands of years. And so the timescales on which these processes occur are a lot longer than generational timescales, human generational timescales, and I could say cynically political re-election timescales. You'd like to see government agencies and planners and politicians sort of approach it in the same way that they seem to be, at least they're starting now to approach issues like climate change. For instance, in California, I'm actually part of a study for California, Oregon, and Washington to evaluate sea level rise scenarios for the entire 21st century. So for a 100-year time period, recognizing that sea level rise is certainly occurring. And the planners say, well, we want to have the best scientific information about what's going to happen so that we can properly plan. That makes a lot of sense to me. You'd like to see the same things happening in terms of earthquakes. I think, for instance, engineering standards are pretty good in California, on the West Coast of U.S. Unfortunately, a lot of the Pacific Northwest simply didn't know about the Cascadia earthquake earthquake possibilities before the 1980s. So a lot of structures are probably substandard in that sense. I think that's well known.
Let's focus on the GPS side of what you do for a second. What kind of technological breakthroughs are occurring in GPS science right now, which make you optimistic that it can make a positive impact in the sustainability field?
So GPS studies of ground motion, which falls under the category of science called geodesy, really has been revolutionized since the 90s because the cost of GPS receivers and antenna dramatically has reduced since then. And so we're able now to put out networks of continuously operating GPS stations. What that allows us to do is to study the processes leading up to earthquakes in much greater detail than we ever could before, as well as the process of the earthquake itself. So, for instance, within minutes to hours after the Japanese earthquake, there were maps of motion of the Earth's surface, which could then be used to study the entire process. So, for instance, at Cascadia, GPS has allowed the discovery of an amazing phenomenon, which is called slow slip. Basically, that subduction zone, the same subduction zone that can cause these big magnitude 9 earthquakes, every 14 months, it has a little slip event, which is like a magnitude 6 or 6.5 size earthquake, but without the seismic shaking. So this thing just slips, and we wouldn't know about it if we didn't have GPS to show us the ground motion. It turns out that actually the probability of a great earthquake occurring is increased during these times of slip. And with GPS, we can monitor essentially the state of failure probability on these great planes.
My guest on Sea Change Radio has been the director of the Pacific GPS facility at the Hawaii Institute of Geophysics and Planetology at the University of Hawaii, Dr. Ben Brooks. Ben, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks a lot, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Leroy Hudson, Neil Young, and The Grateful Dead. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialists and Incredible Adventures, an eco-friendly outdoor travel company. Go to incadventures.com to learn more. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.